Production. Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Hello, folks. I'm Lynn, and I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone, along with my co-hosts, Bobby Neer, Robert, and Dave. I do hope everyone had a wonderful holiday season. We took an extra week off, and Robert was good enough to record and upload two wonderful commentary shows to fill in the gap. And those commentaries are on the last episode of Season 2, titled The Obsolete Man, starring the incomparable Burgess Meredith, of course, and the first episode of Season 3, titled 2, starring Charles Bronson and Elizabeth Montgomery. And these great commentaries can be heard anytime by going to our show link here at TalkShoe. And the show link, of course, is 68228. Robert, I do want to thank you for doing such a terrific job on those commentaries. They were absolutely wonderful.
You're quite
wonderful.
Welcome, Lynn. I really enjoyed doing them. I'm glad you guys got to listen and to
they
enjoy
were,
them.
They were great. You did a fabulous job. Thank you so
hope
much.
I didn't do too much information overload for everybody, but it
oh,
was kind of nice
no,
digging
no.
all that stuff up.
They were wonderful, and that was a great filler for the time that we weren't here. Thank you so much. And hello
no
to Felix. Our friend Felix is here. Oh, he never fails us. Thanks,
he's from
Felix.
Boise. Hi, Felix.
He's from Felix from New Jersey. Hello, Felix. So glad to have you here. Okay, today's episode is titled The Shelter.
Repeating that.
What is this? Shelter?
4 minutes ago, the President of the United States made the following announcement. I quote, at 11.04 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, both our distant early warning line and ballistics early warning line reported radar evidence of unidentified flying objects flying due southeast. As of this moment, we have been unable to determine the nature of these objects, but for the time being, in the interest of national safety, we are declaring a state of yellow alert. The civil defense authorities request that if you have a shelter already prepared, go there at once. If you do not have
Come
a shelter,
on, Marty.
Use your time to move supplies of food, water, medicine, and other supplies to a central place. Keep all windows and doors closed. We repeat, if you're in your home, go to your prepared shelters or to your basement.
And now, Mr. Serling.
What you're about to watch is a nightmare. It is not meant to be prophetic. It need not happen. It's the fervent and urgent prayer of all men of goodwill that it never shall happen. But in this place, in this moment, it does happen. This is the Twilight Zone.
The shelter begins with a birthday party at the home of Dr. Stockton. And it's the good doctor's birthday, and he's celebrating with his closest friends and neighbors, who on the surface all appear to be the best of friends. Suddenly, an announcer comes on the radio and says that radar has detected unidentified flying objects in the sky and that everyone should go to their bomb shelters or basements. Well, Doc Stockton is the only one of those neighbors who had the good sense to build a bomb shelter for his family, and his friends actually made jokes about his shelter, about all the noise and the hammering at night, and, you know, just he was kind of a nuisance to them. Well, now that panic has set in over the radio announcement, every one of those people who made fun of him is begging Doc Stockton to let him and their family into the shelter. The doc refuses, of course, explaining that the shelter was built for him and his family alone, and it was only built to house three people. There's only enough room, food, water, and air for him, his wife, and his young son. And he had warned all of them to give up some of their fun and games and build their own shelters, but they didn't listen. Well, these people won't take no for an answer and decide to take matters in their own hands. So while arguing over what to do about getting into the shelter, their bigotry and violent ways surface. Finally, they all get a large pipe or I don't know, a pipe or a log or something, and they use it to bash in the door of the shelter. And just as they get it open, an announcement comes on the radio that the UFOs have been identified as harmless satellites. The neighbors, they try apologizing to each other. Oh, I didn't mean it. I didn't mean to say that. I didn't mean to punch you in the face. But mostly they're apologizing to Doc Stockton for acting like animals and destroying his shelter. And they tell him they'll pay for the repairs. But the doctor, he will have none of this. And he lets them know that the damage they've done to themselves and each other cannot be repaired. So, in my opinion, a Twilight Zone episode is a classic if it's one that almost immediately comes to mind whenever I think of the series. And The Shelter is certainly one of those episodes, along with Time Enough at Last, The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, Living Doll, and others. This episode is one of those. It's about a family's conflict, one family's conflict, with their neighbors over a bomb shelter, and it's right up there with one of the classics. There's no science fiction, supernatural, or fantasy elements to the story. It's just a very well-written and well-acted cautionary morality tale. I think Rod Serling wrote a great story here about human nature and the lengths that people go to for survival. The scary part, and think about this, the scary part is that the scenario in the story was very realistic, since nuclear war was and still is a very real threat. And it was especially frightening in the 1960s, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, if anyone was alive and lived through that, even the atmosphere of the episode has a dark and disturbing feel to it. The nighttime, you know, it's during the day, but then it goes into the nighttime, and then you have the dimly lit basement and the confined quarters of Dr. Stockton's shelter, and that all added to that crisis feeling, you know, that crazy, eerie feeling. And watching the good doctor's friends turn on him and then on each other, that reminded me very much of the scenario in The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. Except that no one got killed in the shelter. However, if those people had completely broken down the door to that bomb shelter, it wouldn't have surprised me if someone ended up getting beaten to death, because it was obvious that all of them could not fit in there. And let's face it, Frank Henderson wasted no time flinging ethnic insults at Marty before punching him in the jaw. I mean, he punched him in the face after, you know, saying, oh, foreigners, you know, this is what happens when you foreigners come over here. And later, when everything calmed down, he tried to apologize to Marty by saying he didn't mean any of the terrible things he said. Really? It seems to me that his insults came pretty fast and furious and with little effort. So I don't think any amount of money or block parties can repair the damage that these people did to themselves and each other. I mean, how could they ever get together again without feeling strained in their relationships? I can't even imagine the doctor ever welcoming these people into his home again. And to make matters worse, you had to all see this. To make matters worse, they knocked over his dining room table with everything on it when they ran through with the battering ram. And they didn't even stop to help clean up the mess on their way out. I also found it interesting how Jerry and Marty were totally against bashing in the door, but within minutes, they both had their hands around the battering ram. I suppose they figured they were in the minority, so they had no choice but to join the angry mob. So it was understandable that Dr. Stockton wanted him and his family to survive, which that's why he built the shelter. It was also understandable that everyone else wanted to survive, but they had no right to demand entry into the doctor's shelter. He was right when he told Jerry that they could easily have built their own shelters if they'd given up some of their card parties and weekend barbecues. And yet Stockton's wife even wondered if it was worth it to survive the destruction, and the doctor told his wife that they needed to survive for their son, who was only 12 years old. Well, I understand that reasoning, but realistically, the kid most likely wasn't going to make it to 13 if they did survive. I have to wonder if death by radiation and from eating contaminated food is the better choice. Who knows? In reality, the shelter, they were basically doomed. By the way, I don't know if anyone else noticed this or thought this, but I thought the door of the shelter was too easily beaten in for something that's supposed to withstand a nuclear blast. I mean, I don't know if that's nitpicking, but that door was easily broken into.
Basically. I mean, you put a wooden door on and say it's a It's a big stainless steel door when it's actually a piece of plywood.
That thing was like, you know, they just battered that thing. It would have taken about 5 bashes and the thing was broken into. Yeah, that's going to survive a nuclear blast, all right?
Kick in the door and break my foot. Oh, we're in now.
Maybe I could, you know, just bash it in, just throw a couple of chairs against it. But, hey, you know, it's also interesting to note, and I think I'm right about it, exactly 1 week after this episode aired, President Kennedy, he advised the American families to build bomb shelters to protect themselves from atomic fallout in the event of a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union. That was about 1 week, almost exactly 1 week after this episode aired. And one other thing, I have to mention this. An episode of The Simpsons called Bart's Comet parodied the shelter when the entire neighborhood, Simpsons neighborhood, attempts to escape a meteor that's destined for Springfield by squeezing into a bomb shelter. And there's enough room for everybody except the one person who's forced to stay outside and face Armageddon. And that one person is the person who built the bomb shelter. So I love this episode. I think it's realistic. I think it's disturbing. And it's definitely one of Rod Serling's best efforts. And it's great acting by everyone. And I always enjoy seeing Sandy Kenyon and Jack Albertson. So this is a 5. I give this a 5 for a classic episode. And what Felix said, Felix stayed in with plenty of champagne. Well, if you were in bomb shelter and you had plenty of
good
champagne,
for you.
Okay, then, yeah, good for you. You'd be all right with that.
Now, 20 and a half minutes before 10 on the KNX clock's the time, 20 and a half before 10. We promised 13 different people this morning we would ask you this question about a Twilight Zone that was on about a month or so ago. It was concerning fallout shelters. Now, on this, you must have had quite a bit of reaction.
We had 1,300 letters and cards inside of 2 days. I think we hit some kind of a nerve. It was a show called The Shelter, about a doctor who was the only guy in the neighborhood who had the presence of mind and the foresight to build a shelter.
Yeah.
And when there's a yellow alert sounding, why, he runs into the shelter with his wife and child, and all the neighbors are left high and dry, and they turn into animals. And I used the show. I wrote it because I felt, number one, it had great immediacy. We've been talking at home, my wife and me, about the possibility of building a shelter.
Yeah.
And we were struck with the moral and ethical problem of what would happen if, you know, there were an alert sounding.
Yeah.
We got into our shelter happily because we'd built one, and neighbors with children came to the door and said, please let us in. Well, that was the problem. I can't answer it. I don't know what is the ethical rightness and justice of this. I haven't figured it out yet.
It is a very controversial thing because I saw a panel discussion just about a week or so ago on this, and they had some learned men on the panel, one gentleman with civil defense, another who was in the clergy, Catholic priest, a Jesuit priest, and they all had different opinions. One gentleman said in particular, until the government starts building them themselves, public shelters, I can't see where there's this immediacy is here. You know, why should I go out and spend $2,000 or $3,000 to build one if the government isn't bothering? This was his feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So I can imagine when I saw your show that night, which was this problem in its most dramatic terms. Here was a family in their shelter, as you said, and here were the neighbors. What do? You carry a gun with you, shoot them off, or what do? And your show finally ended. It was a false alarm.
It was a yellow alert, which turned out to be nothing. But I think the essence of our philosophical comment at the end was that for the human race to survive, it has to remain civilized.
Now, was that the ending that you wanted to take, or did you want to leave it a little bit stronger?
No, because I'm not one of those, quote, knowledgeable men, Bob.
No.
I don't know. I was up in the air about it, morally and ethically. I didn't know how to end that thing. I didn't know what position philosophically I could take.
Are you yourself building a shelter?
No, we're not now.
Were you?
For a while, we thought very seriously of it. Yeah, we did.
Yeah.
And now we've decided that, no, we're not going to build it.
Why?
Well, for very realistic, you know, stringently realistic reasons, that it's my feeling now that if we survive, what do we survive for? What kind of a world do we go into? You know, if it's rubble and poison water and unedible food, and my kids have to live like wild beasts, I'm not particularly sure I want to survive in that kind of a world. This is the happy show, Bob, and Yak it up again, Bob.
So, Robert, I'm going to put this over to you.
Okay, thank you, Lynn. Yeah, let me ask you a question before I go on. Is it partially experience for your rating of why you liked the episode? Because were you around? You were around during the time, weren't you, when they were having the bomb shows back in the 60s? Were you?
Lynn is just a young girl. Come on,
get young, but I was around.
Get real.
Mm-hmm. I was about 4 or 5 years old.
Lynn is still a teenager. Come on.
Okay.
No, I was born in 1959. So, yeah, I was around, but I didn't experience it in the schools, but my brother did. My brother had the duck and cover. He went through that, yeah.
Right. I probably should have geared that towards Bobby, so.
But, yeah, Bobby,
be mean or nothing.
But. I only know what my grandfather told me. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, Bobby rode his dinosaur to school, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Remind me.
I had a kind of a different feel for the shelter. It was okay to me, and... I did originally give it a 2.5 out of 5, but I did change it to a 3 after reviewing it again. I just can't get it to a classic, and I don't know if it's just, there's nothing that majorly wrong with the story. The one thing that really kind of interests me is just the gullibility of the people thinking that the way the bomb shelter was built, that even with the air, that you're going to survive a nuclear holocaust, especially when the radiation that saturates the earth is brought into your shelter through recycled air. So you end up having a slow death eventually anyway. Mm-hmm. And so you contaminate all your food in the shelter, you contaminate everything in there, and then, maybe 5 years or whatever, you'll be dead. So, and the whole thing is that what you said, Lynn, when you're stripped down to, survival instincts, I mean, you don't, where you take away the veneer of humanity and you're left with just survival instincts.
It's just a panic.
You don't really.
In the panic mode,
Yeah, you don't think about how big a shelter is. All you can think about is you and your family and nobody else.
And you want to get in there and you could care less about anything else. You just want to survive.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's when the survival instinct takes over on that. I think a lot of people could tie into the story, and that's why I asked the question, was maybe for sentimental reasons is why people probably took a higher look at this episode. Well, I was born in 63, so I pretty much bypassed all that stuff and never seen a bomb shelter in my life except for what was on TV or what I read in books, so, I never never truly experienced what they went through. So, I equate this as just a regular story for myself. But it did bring up, as Lynn said, there's no supernatural science fiction elements. It's a morality play, pretty much. Along the same lines as Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, where the aliens were playing mind games on a neighborhood community. So we get the story with this as well. It kind of reminds you later on of a episode that is coming up called One More Pallbearer, of course,
mm-hmm.
written by Ron Serling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That one we'll be discussing, a few episodes down the road here. But, it very much reminded me of Escape from L.A., Mad Max, The Postman, Waterworld, The Stand.
From Stephen King, the master of suspense, comes his all-time bestseller.
Containment breach! You've had a major containment breach! Use the manual gate override, Champion! Do it now! Champion, you have to close the gate!
A deadly virus released by a government mistake. A frantic military willing to stop at nothing to cover up the terrible truth.
So-called super flu does not exist.
What did you do? What did you people do?
As the plague sweeps out of control, a nation erupts, society crumbles, the end is here.
The monster's here! The darkness here!
Now, all that remains, the demon, the prophet, and those chosen to survive. drawn by dreams of an old woman.
You're coming along to see me, won't you, Larry?
The chosen ones stream to Colorado to find their dreams are real.
Help us to be true, dear Lord. Help us to stand.
Las Vegas, an army of darkness assembles, controlled by dreams of their leader, Randall Flagg.
Go for it.
Do it, Harold, do it!
It's time to make your stand.
The ultimate stand against the forces of evil. Molly Ringwald, Rob Lowe, Laura San Giacomo, Gary Sinise, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Ruby Dee, and Jamie Sheridan. Stephen King's The Stand.
Examples of post-apocalyptic survival, yeah, where, you know, you have small groups of people surviving,
mm-hmm,
and you can see how they reacted. Humanity is thrown out a window, and then, you know, the will to survive is what the main force is behind these people. So, you know, I can pretty much see with this episode. But as I said, to me, it was an average good story, pretty much how I marked it. It did remind me of a couple of movies, TV. One was called Blast from the Past with Brendan Fraser, Lee Silverstone.
Yeah.
Christopher, mm-hmm, Walken, Sissy Spacek, that was set during the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
In 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis was heating up, and the threat of nuclear war drove the Weber family underground.
How long will we have to stay down here?
35 years.
35 years.
For three decades, they lived a fairly normal life.
That's right.
But their son has become a man.
What did you wish for, son?
Now the time has come.
I wish that I could meet a girl.
For Adam to step out and discover the world.
What is it?
The sky. I have never in my life seen anything like it before.
Oh, my lucky stars. A Negro.
Say what? Well, I come
around. Bonsoir, mademoiselle.
Let me guess something. This is your first visit to La La Land.
Eve, this guy is unbelievable.
Oh, you dial 9 to get out.
Of what?
The hotel.
Where on earth are you from?
Maybe Eve can guess.
Give me your hand. Okay. You live in Alaska. Are we getting hot?
Yes.
From New Line Cinema.
I've never driven before.
And the director of the First Wives Club.
Hi. One champagne cocktail. Oh.
I thought only hookers drank this.
Well, I know Mom sure likes them.
Comes a story about a guy in his 30s.
What have you been doing?
Been watching television. In color.
Stuck in the 60s.
I love sushi.
I love Lucy.
Looking for love in the 90s.
You're a nice boy. But what Eve needs is a nice man.
I'm Heather.
I don't believe I've ever heard that name before.
Go on, Romeo.
Shall we dance?
He drives a great big car, smokes a big cigar. He looks like a king and he acts like a star. When we see him drive by, he goes boop, boop. We all shout, hey, Mr. Zuzu.
You're in love with a guy.
What?
A man walks into your life. Who's the kindest.
Don't be such a baby.
Oh, I'm the baby?
Most incredible guy you've ever met.
No.
Brendan Fraser, Alicia Silverstone, Christopher Walken, and Sissy Spacek. Blast from the past.
Eve, can I skate around your block?
How about it, Eve? Can you skate around your block? Can I ask you some questions?
Hmm?
When did Alaska become a state?
1959.
Okay, and who owned it before we did?
Russia.
And when did we get it from them?
1867, Seward's Folly. We purchased it for $7.2 million. Tidy sum then as well as now. I'm quoting my father, of course.
All right, what's the state capital?
Juneau.
Hello, it's Anchorage. Gotcha.
Mm-mm, sorry, that's the largest city. Where's he going?
He's going to check your answers on his computer.
He has a computer.
Sure.
In the house.
No, actually, it's in the backyard. Of course it's in the house. It's in there.
May I be excused, please?
Yeah.
They head into their shelters because of the false alarm, lock themselves in, and don't come back out to 1997.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it just shows how they're trying to recirculate themselves in that era.
Of course, his wife, you know, when his wife said, what do we want to survive for? I mean, you know, of course, you know, he reasoned with her about having to survive for the kid. But, you know, like I said, the kid's not probably not even going to live to be 13 through the radiation. But she says, well, but you can understand her feeling. She says, what do we want to survive for? To go out and walk through the rubble and walk through the dead bodies of our friends? You know, in a way, you can see why what she means, you know. It's like Henry Venus in Time Enough to Last. Do you really want to be the last survivors or a few of the last survivors?
Remember with the Terminator movies how, you know, after the war with the machines, how the Earth looked. Imagine it without the machines. You get kind of
exactly.
Similar idea.
And you're kind of
that.
You're kind of like roaming around all by yourself with nobody and nothing, and you're going to die eventually anyway, you know?
Yeah, with a can of chicken sitting around and eating.
And chicken. Exactly.
And non-existent rainwater.
You got that right.
The other thing reminded me of was, go ahead, Lynn.
No, I was going to say, so what do you think about the fact that if they did come out of there, do you think that they would have been the only ones, or you think other people were building bomb shelters?
Yeah, I have to believe that, you know, with all these stories and, you know, books, movies, and everything, you know, they come down to this one person survival type thing. I don't agree with that. I believe there's different degrees of the way people are. I don't think, you know, after explosion that, you know, there's going to be remnants of people scattered in other areas. How far away, who knows? But I don't buy into the one person being the only survivor.
Oh, yeah,
of
you can't believe
the Holocaust. No.
You can't believe that doctor was the only person who built a bomb shelter. I mean, someone else did. You know?
Well,
I mean,
look at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's still people that survived those explosions.
Yeah.
So.
Exactly.
Yeah. The other one I was going to bring up is the one from Quantum Leap, and the episode was called Nuclear Family, the season 3, episode 51.
Realizing that one could time travel within his own lifetime, Dr. Sam Beckett stepped into the Quantum Leap accelerator. He awoke to find himself trapped in the past, facing mirror images that were not his own, and driven by an unknown force to change history for the better. His only guide on this journey is Al, an observer from his own time, who appears in the form of a hologram that only Sam can see and hear. And so Dr. Beckett finds himself leaping from life to life, striving to put right what once went wrong, and hoping each time that his next leap will be the leap home.
Why?
The Ruskies just lobbed a bomb on New York City!
What?
It's World War III!
Get down, right now! Come on, Al!
Al, I'm an atom bomb shelter salesman.
Well, actually, you're a junior at Oklahoma State.
Eddie Elroy.
Yeah. Apparently, you lost your basketball scholarship when you wrecked your knee.
Yeah, Max said something about, I'm here selling bomb shelters to make money to finish school.
Well, you know, that's a good business to go into. This October 26, 1962 is right at the height.
Cuban Missile Crisis, I know.
That's right.
I know, yeah, look at this place. And you got gas masks. Look at this thing. It's a radiation chart. And they got atomic rumpus rooms, but there's no nuclear war.
Yeah, but people didn't know that then. We all thought maybe it was the end of the world.
We?
Well, see, your Swiss cheese, or you're too young to remember what the Cuban Missile Crisis really was like.
Well, look, Elkridge, Indiana wasn't exactly ground zero. I can barely remember what happened, except for my mom, because she was, like, canning food like crazy. But we didn't live near a big city, so, you know, it didn't seem so scary. Plus, I was only 8.
Didn't seem scary.
Well, no.
You weren't flying reconnaissance flights over Cuba.
You flew reconnaissance flights?
I was in an F-4 Phantom Escort. One of our U-2s got shot down photographing the missile bases, and my squadron went in right after that. And, Sam, I gotta tell you, you don't realize how close we came to World War III. I mean, total annihilation.
But Kennedy doesn't attack Cuba, and Khrushchev removes all the missiles, right?
That's right.
And in that one, Sam leads to the body of Eddie Elroy, a college student who's visiting his brother in South Florida during the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, October of 1962. His brother sells bomb shelters for a living, and in a panic, it causes him to go into the bomb shelter while a neighbor tries to break in. So it's very similar to the shelter, you know, they're trying to lock themselves in. Someone tries to break in to get into that shelter there. Yeah, pretty much, like I said, it was an average to good story. I did bump it up from 2.5 to 3. So, and
okay. Yeah.
There was another person that felt the same way with me on the 3, but for most, it's 4 and 5 for the story. And that's pretty good, you know, compared to, you know, there's nothing, you know, below 2.5. So evidently, this is a well-received story by a lot of people. So I'll go ahead and pass this on to Bobby.
Excuse me. Thank you very much. Yeah, actually, far be it from me to suggest that Rod Serling had a rather dark obsession with the end of the world, because he did a lot of stories involving that, either the end of the world or people's reaction to the end of the world. This story is really just a rehash of The Monsters Are Doing Maple Street. It's basically the same story, with everybody losing their minds because they feel greatly threatened until they turn on each other. And Monsters is a classic story, and I think this one is too. But certainly, we've certainly had, of course, that was the tenor of the times back then. And people really were afraid of that. In my review on the board at our group, I tell a story about the Cuban Missile Crisis and being a teenager back then, and how incredibly scary it was. And it really was quite frightening. As a matter of fact, if I look back on my life, I would say I was probably more scared at that time than I've ever been over anything. I mean, I lived through a lot of history, a lot of bad times, presidents being assassinated and everything. But that was really a very scary time. And my friends and I really thought we were going to die. I mean, this was for real. This wasn't a TV show. This was the real thing. And I simply remember that I used to read the Time, Life magazine back then. Used to do big photo layouts about building your own shelter. And by the way, everybody here on the story, and even here in our discussion, calls it a bomb shelter. But in reality, back then, it was known as a fallout shelter because the whole purpose was to survive. Obviously, if you're not in a place where you're protected, you're going to get blown to bits without even knowing what hit you. So the idea was to simply survive that and then take your chances afterwards. It was a ludicrous idea from the very beginning. It was silly to think that you were going to crawl in a hole somewhere and get out and survive. And anybody who doesn't believe that needs to talk to Henry Bemis and find out how happy he was to survive. Woman in the store, yeah.
Weren't some of the shelters also built in basements of stores and schools?
Well, that's it, yes.
Like
so back
that?
In the Cuban Missile Crisis, I was furious with my father because I was reading all the time, well, if you're not going to build a fallout shelter, at least put some food in your basement. Do something. And we had a basement. We actually had a basement that was below the house. It wasn't fortified in any way, but it was below the house. It would have been better than standing outside. And I was really very angry. And I thought to myself, why did we do this? We did nothing. He thought the whole thing, he wasn't about to build a fallout shelter. But I thought, I actually would say so. Shouldn't we put something in the basement? Shouldn't we do something just in case? And everybody just laughed at me like, don't be ridiculous. And so when the Cuban Missile Crisis came along, it actually come true, or almost, and that was really frightening. The irony of the whole idea of having a fallout shelter is really a joke, because since nuclear weapons were developed, and the United States and the Soviet Union especially, armed themselves to the teeth, The whole idea was to make it so impossible to have a nuclear war to not be able to survive, so that nobody would dare to do it, or as it's known, you know, mad, mutually assured destruction. So actually, thankfully, this hasn't happened so far. That doesn't mean it won't one day. But if you make it possible for people to survive a nuclear war, that actually adds to the possibility of having a nuclear war. Because on one side or the other thinks, you know what, we'll build fallout shelters, we'll put our people in it, and we'll bomb the hell out of them, and they'll be gone, and I'll take care of that. We'll win the war. So the only thing that's kept us alive this long is the fact that nobody dares to do it. I mean, because you know that there's no surviving it at all. And so, but the very concept itself of surviving anything like that is just ridiculous. And like I said, they were known as fallout shelters back then. That was the big issue, not just this big explosion, but the fallout. What was going to happen if you survived? You were just going to get deathly ill, and it was going to be horrible. What really I find rather amusing about this episode, if there's anything amusing about it at all, is that when it starts and that Conelrad, there's a throwback to the past, is now the emergency broadcast system, used to be called Conelrad, and when the kid comes in, he says he heard this on the radio, everybody automatically assumes that it's missiles heading there. But the word was that the kid said, or they said on the news, that it was unidentified flying objects. Well, unidentified flying objects could be anything. It could be aliens from outer space. It could be, I don't know, that you could automatically assume that that's nuclear war just because there's something out there we don't know what it is.
They assumed it was a bomb right off the bat.
Well, yeah, I mean they got into a panic right away. Well, oh, that's got to be what it is. How about just thinking and trying to find out what it is? Of course, you know, they come in with this announcement. The president, if the president comes on and says, you better take shelter, do you think people are going to panic or what? I mean, of course, if you're going to tell anybody that. The whole thing is just a joke, because if anybody ever dares to do that, or I think it's much more dangerous that there could be a mistake one day, or that it could be done by accident or something like that, than that anybody would really be insane enough to do this. But right away, they just assume that it's bombs heading there. The business about everybody climbing over each other, well, that's, I mean, sure. It amazes me that the doctor who built that didn't really think to himself, since he never planned to invite any of his friends in anyway, that if push came to shove and one day something happened, this wasn't going to happen. I mean, you can see this coming down the road. It's obvious. What are they going to do? Just stand there and die while his family survives? It's irrational to even think that. Another thing that amazed me was that only his personal friends that were at the party went crazy. Well, it was everybody else in the neighborhood. Everybody else in the neighborhood mad at him too? Because I would think there'd be a lot more people at his door than just those few people. Because it sounded like nobody else in the neighborhood managed.
There was only one guy came to the door who wasn't at the party.
Yeah,
remember
but I'm
the
saying,
guy?
There's people all over the neighborhood. He's going to have a bigger panic on his hands than he thinks. My question is, what I'd like to throw out there was, what do you think? Do you think that he really had a moral obligation to let anybody else in? Or is his family comes first?
No. And you wouldn't be able to fit anybody in there. That's the whole thing. He's being realistic with them.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That, hey, it's only for him and his family. How are you going to fit everybody in there? There's no way. And you
I
see
know.
How small that thing
and
was.
And didn't he say to them, I told you all,
for them.
I warned you, I told you to build your own shelters, I told you to give up the card parties and the barbecues and build your shelter, and now they didn't want to listen. They didn't want to have fun. They thought it was all a joke. And now that there's a threat, they want to jump in his hole. Forget that.
Well, a whole shelter comes down to income, too. How were the income of the people that they could afford to build a bomb shelter? Now, he was a doctor. Evidently, he was pretty good financial-wise that he could build a bomb shelter. At least my understanding what I read, that bomb shelters were really expensive.
Exactly, but that still doesn't obligate him to let those people in, right?
No.
Well, I consider it a classic episode, but not necessarily because of the story. I tend to agree with Robert that it is, you know, it's a pretty obvious story. You know where it's going. It was from the minute it starts. But what I really liked about it was the acting. I think this is one of the best acting ensembles in the entire series in this particular episode. A lot of character actors in there that had already been around for years. And they do it well. I always appreciate actors who make it real, who throw themselves into it so much that they convince me that it's really happening. These people really look terrified. I mean, this is just a fictional story, but they really look terrified, and that scares the hell out of me to see them do that. So that's one of the things about the episode that I like the best. But it just seems odd. And it also seems odd to me, they mentioned, oh, we put up with the cement trucks in the middle of the night and all the hammering and the pounding and all of that. That this didn't come up before this was ever finished. That somebody didn't say, oh, of course, now if anything ever happens, of course you're going to remember your friends, right? Everybody seemed shocked that they went crazy.
They all made a joke out of it. They all thought it was a joke.
You can see it coming. And even the doctor, I think, should have thought to himself, "But I can't invite them in. It's like everybody just said, I don't have room in there for that. We don't have enough food, water, anything. But what are my friends going to do? I mean, are they just going to sit back and die? I think it's a little irrational. I think this is the kind of thing you have to see. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what, in reality, what anybody would do. Now, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, I had no idea whether anybody in our neighborhood had a fallout shelter. I had no idea. I was in many of their houses. I didn't see anything, so I rather doubt it. But that was so much in the news back then that it just really disturbed me, because I thought, I just wanted to do something minor. I knew my father would never build a fallout shelter, but I thought to myself, because they used to say, if you're not going to do anything, if you're not going to build anything, at least get something ready so you have some chance at all. But we wouldn't even do that. So it really scared me badly. And I just think and what I find most interesting about the threat of nuclear war is that this is completely forgotten today. It's like it never existed. It was the most compelling thing back then. And
right.
50 years later, nobody talks about it at all.
Yeah.
You don't see it on the news. They never do any kind of reports. Nothing. And I'm sure there are fallout shelters somewhere, but if they're not stocked, and they haven't been stocked since 1961, they, of course, aren't any good anyway.
I'm sure there's some that haven't been built.
I have a story to tell, and I really can't believe this has happened to me yesterday. The timing was amazing. I just happened to be watching the CBS Evening News, which I don't always watch, but I had it on. And they did a report right at the end of the news. At first, I didn't pay much attention to it until I thought to myself, my goodness, this plays right into what we're doing tomorrow. A man, I don't know what he does for a living, with a lot of money apparently, who really is a survivalist, that's what they call them today, who doesn't only think the world's going to end in a nuclear war, but a lot of terrible things could happen. Actually, this is in Kansas. The United States government apparently abandoned some missile silos that were in Kansas, I don't know, recently or whatever, either because they were outdated or they moved them somewhere else or something. And they just stripped them down. It took everything out, all the classified material, all that, out of them. These were silos for the missiles, not for people to hide in. And they sold them. They put them on the market for anybody who wanted to buy them. This guy actually bought them. He actually bought them with the intention of starting his own company and making a state-of-the-art fallout shelter and then selling it. And I just sat there with my mouth open watching this. He devised, and they let the reporter in there to see it, this amazing fallout shelter. Now, I'm not just talking about a little shelter. I'm talking about, it's like a cavern. It's like a cave. Because, you know, you can imagine missile silos, how deep they go into the ground. And not only he's got food and water in there, the reporter said he doesn't just have food in there. He's got a supermarket in there. I mean, he's got enough food for God only knows how long. It's got its own power source, everything you can imagine. I have no idea how much money he's taking into it.
Did you say he sold it?
Well, I'm getting to that. So he did all of this and started his own company. And then the reporter says, unfortunately, only one other person has bought it from him. Nobody else wants any part of it. Well, I'm sure it costs a fortune. I don't know what the total amount was. And it really was quite impressive. This guy's a real genius. And but he's what they call a survivalist today. He's not worried about – so the reporter said to him, what is it you're expecting? And he said, well, it's not just nuclear war. It's terrorism, terrorists with a dirty bomb, a meteor hitting the earth. I mean, you know, a comet or a meteor is going to hit the earth, and he's going to survive. I'm not so sure about that. And but the most interesting part of it came at the very end, and it plays right into this episode. So the reporter said, well, you know, this is very impressive and all that. And then he kind of made a little joke, and he looked at me and said, but he said, you're selling these, he said. But just between you and me, if something happened right now while we're doing this report, there was a nuclear war broke out or something terrible happened, I'm sure you would let me in. I'll bet you would let me in. And the guy looks at him without smiling at all, and he says, don't bet on it. You lose that bet. He made it very clear to him that he's not letting anybody in there at all. So I thought to myself, you know what? Nothing has changed in 50 years. If anybody has a shelter, they're not going to let you in anymore today. than they would have done it back in 1961.
Exactly.
It's the same difference. But this is an amazing thing to see. He's not making any money off of it, but, you know, but today, back in the early 60s, it was all about nuclear war. Now it's not. It's gone way past that. Survivalists are convinced that something horrible is going to happen. The Earth is going to explode. Global warming, the sun is going to drift away from the Earth. We're going to go out of orbit. God only knows what can happen. So he built this thing. Could he survive down there? Well, he might be able to. I mean, this thing is absolutely huge. It's gigantic. And the government actually sold it to him. They had nothing to do with it. And this is right in the middle of Kansas, which is where a lot of the nuclear weapons are. And he's not hiding down there. He just has it there if he needs it. Now, my question would be, what if you're away from home when something breaks out? You can't be guaranteed that you're going to be in the right place at the right time. I don't care what you build. But I think it's a good story. We recently had a short discussion on the board at our group about when we did that horrible comedy episode, Once Upon a Time. Everybody chiming in, especially me, about how we don't like comedy in the Twilight Zone. And I had posted back and said, I go to watch the Twilight Zone to either be creeped out or disturbed. And a couple of people came back and said, well, I mean, what do you mean by disturbed? What do you mean by this, that, and the other? This episode is disturbing to me. Any episode of the Twilight Zone that is a piece of real life, and you can look at it, science fiction is one thing. You can look at things like space aliens landing and say, yeah, it's science fiction, but how likely is that to happen? But a story like this is a slice of real life. This could really, really happen. You could be faced with this, and your neighbors could come and bang down your door, and that I would classify not as creepy or scary, but just disturbing. I think Serling really had his finger on human behavior and what people are going to do, but it's like everybody just said, this man had no moral obligation to save anyone. But it's unfortunate that we have to realize that in the case of a dire emergency, humans, instead of banding together to help each other out of the problem, are more likely to step over each other in order to survive. But I don't know. Animals do that, too. I mean, we should be a little bit beyond that. But let me ask one more question before I end this, in that we're talking about, you said he couldn't survive, they couldn't survive all those people in there. Suppose it was something lesser than this, like a tornado or something. Is he morally obligated to let people get into a shelter to survive in that case? I mean, just for a day or two.
Oh, if it's just a hurricane or a tornado and you can fit people in, yeah. But, I mean, if it's a survival of the fittest, you know, like a nuclear type of thing, no, absolutely not. No, but if you're talking about a tornado, a hurricane, you know, something that's not a long-lasting...
Yeah, that might last a week or less.
Yeah, you can let some people in. Some people.
Yeah, because I think it's different circumstances what a tornado has compared to a nuclear holocaust, so...
Exactly.
I would imagine he probably would let some people who try to fit in what he can into the shelter, because like you said, it's not a long-term, it's a temporary situation. Nuclear holocaust is for life, so you
sure. And it depends on what you like the person. I mean, if I don't like somebody, they're not getting in.
Yeah, it would draw
I also have to agree with everybody that, you know, if they could just break the door down, you wasted your time. He certainly wasted his money building that. But you know what that's all about. That's the endless CBS on Rod Serling's back about keeping the budget under control. So, you know, they weren't about to spend any money to build something elaborate or something that looked real. I mean, that really, I'm always amazed by that every time I read that he was badgered to death about keeping the budget under control for this series. It was hugely successful for them. And to tell that man that some of these episodes feature, you know, just look bad because you see they were done for pennies on the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is unfortunate. I think they should have left him alone. They made plenty of money off of it. They didn't need to do that. Anyway, I'll keep it at 5. Yeah, I think it's a classic episode, but I think somebody like me who lived through something similar to that with the missile crisis, I envy Robert because he wasn't born until after the missile crisis. You're very fortunate. Believe me, you didn't want to be there for that. And all I know is we sit here every day and we don't even think about it at all. We don't worry, but we're about terrorists. There's plenty of reason to worry about it. I mean, whoever thought that the World Trade Center could be brought down by two airplanes? You can't just automatically assume that things are too unlikely to ever happen. I don't really know what we would do. I mean, Lynn and I live in an apartment building, so there's certainly nowhere to run to here. McGrath's Wish was able to top floor of it yet. And I have no idea what people would do. Probably the doctor's wife, who said, what's the point of all this? Maybe we'll all just sit here and just give up. May be true, but that's not what human beings are all about. We wouldn't be here today if we thought about that. Because after all, and I always say, what's the point of having a fallout shelter if you can't come out of there anyway? Or you come out of there and there's so much radiation around,
right. You're doomed.
But if you take that to another further step, what's the point of living life? Because you know you're going to die at the end of it anyway. It's a losing game for everybody. You live to be 150, and you're still going to lose at the end, but we do it anyway. We don't just sit back and go, you know what, why should I go to work and do all of this? Because I'm not going to make it. It's as simple as that. I don't think that's what humans are all about. So it doesn't really surprise me that people would have wanted to survive and see what happened. But time in Lafayette should have taught everybody that you honestly don't want to be the last one around. That is a horrible, horrible, horrible thought.
So Bob, do you believe that the government really knew what the situation and what the devastation would be and kind of dumbed it down for the people? So if the situation did get out of control, it wouldn't be that bad, yeah.
Yeah, and well, I think
let them die ignorant.
Well, not only for that, but for our enemies, too. You don't want them to think that we're just going to give up if anything happens, because that would be very tempting. They might say, well, you know, they're scared the hell out. We scared the hell out of them. And maybe we ought to go for this and see if we can take over the world, because they've already given up. So I think the government had to say, look, we're going to get together. We're going to survive no matter what. So don't even think about doing this. I've lived my entire life under the threat of this, and I don't think about it anymore. I did when I was a kid. I really, maybe more than other kids, it really scared me. And this episode, where I saw it originally, really scared me. So I think it's a classic, and I have no complaints about it at all.
So your rating is what?
Five.
All right. Excellent. Okay. So we got a rating of 5, and now Dave.
Well, I've not heard Bobby Swan animated about Twilight Zone episode for ages, so that it was really great to hear, because often he's been a little bit dismissive of the earlier part of the series, and with good reason on his part. And he covered quite a number of things that I will just tick box, because he's already mentioned them. Yeah, it's now the survivalist movement that has really the ancestor of all this with the nuclear fallout things and so on. I heard the story about the fallout, the fellow who bought the silo. It was one of the British programs. I'm not even sure whether, Robert, it was Stephen Fry going around America, and he stopped at one like that. And it was either him or one of the Brits doing a tour of the States, you know.
From one of the shows that he did.
Yeah, yeah. You know. I mean, the thing is, when they do these shows of America, unfortunately, they always focus on the cranks and the, you know, the largest ball of twine in the States and things like that. And I think he did visit one that was a converted underground silo. But I actually really enjoy it, and I certainly would give it a 5 out of 5, which is strange because, again, as Bobby said, this isn't science fiction. This is one of the few episodes where, in fact, there aren't any aliens. It was... what might seem to many listeners to the show now, and even many people on the call, you know, to be a very vague, a very highly unlikely scenario. But it wasn't in the 60s. It was the height of all the Cold War. And I think to answer the question that you proposed, Robert, in one sense, was the fact that I think the government played down an awful lot of that. I think, you know, Some accounts were about 16 hours from a world war. I mean, things were on high alert, you know, DEFCON, whatever they call it. So, I mean, I do think that, and I do remember that they did, you know, people were thinking that, you know, you whitewash your windows to stop the light. The fact that the blooming heat blast and a 300 mile an hour wind to blow your house away, never mind your windows, paint a bit of whitewash on your windows wasn't going to do much good. But quite a lot to say, really. So the other thing I entirely agree with Bobby about is the ensemble acting of this. It was really great. From Jack Albertson, who I know as Charlie's granddad from Charlie
great
and the Chocolate
actor.
Factory.
Yeah.
And all the
Key
other characters.
Yeah.
The other characters are very realistic. I mean, we don't like to think that people are still racist in many ways, but I mean, they very soon turned on the one person who was of, not born in America, an immigrant that was a member of their group, soon turned on him. And I think it was probably, unfortunately, quite a likely documentation of what could have been played out in many, many things. I don't think people were coming from other streets because of the time thing. If you remember, it used to be actually less than that. He said, I thought it was moving at too leisurely a pace. He said between 15 and 30 minutes. But we were talking about originally only having a 4-minute warning of interballistic missiles because, of course, the range was only a few thousand miles in those days, so they were being travelled by bombers. So you were only finding out right at the as they were imposing on the airspace of the country. So it could have even been a lot less than that. I agree also with Bobby that the doctor. I mean, I would have thought. I would have made some comment when all the other families left the house. I'm getting some echo from somewhere. Okay, and when all the other pet families went home, I'd tell my wife to wait a moment, and I'd be glad, and then I'd go and make sure, I said to my son, right, go and lock the back door, lock all the doors. That's the first thing I would have done, locked all the doors, mean as I might be.
Yeah, did you notice people were just walking into his house? People were just walking inside his house.
Well, the one knocked on the back door at the end, but the point is, there was no thing about that, but I thought that was... really good. I mean, there was lots of things. I mean, Robert's already mentioned, like, the Quantum Leap, the nuclear family episode.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a famous book by Neville Shute written by On the Beach. I don't know if you heard of it. I even saw the film.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite movies. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. The book came out in 57, the film in 59, with Fred Astaire doing one of his best acting roles. This were the people in Australia who the Southern Hemisphere had mostly escaped this Third World War, but the radioactive cloud was drifting towards them, and that was an examination of how the different people were spending their last months, knowing for certain that they were going to die. And the Fred Astaire character was mad on speed and racing cars and things. And they were all doing their different pursuits of how to spend that time. There was also here in the UK, it was actually an animated film by, it's called When the Wind Blows. If you ever get a chance to watch that, watch it. Although it's an animated film, it's not a children's cartoon, even though it was produced by Raymond Briggs, the man who did The Snowman, if you've ever seen The Snowman cartoon,
oh, yeah.
Which is very lovely. This is one. Well, he wrote this one. It's called When the Wind Blows. Let me put the link into the text. Let me briefly read what it says on the wiki page, and I'll just put that link in for you a second. It depicts a nuclear attack in the UK by the Soviet Union from the viewpoint of a retired couple, Jim and Hilda Bloggs. They're confused regarding the future and the seriousness of their situation. And the confusion gets steadily darker. As the film progresses, the hopelessness of the couple that suffer from the after effects of radiation sickness, and the film ends on an extremely bleak note. Now, I mean, these were things that people were talking about 30 years ago. Of course, one of the other ones that I'd mention is, in actual fact, it's a science fiction book by Robert Heinlein called Farum's Freehold. Now, it's a funny book because it's in two halves. The second half is very strange and might not be to everybody's taste, and it is complete science fiction. But the whole point about the first part of the book, it's dealt very much in the sort of totally realistic possibility of a nuclear war. This man is exactly like this doctor, but he doesn't go anywhere without his little radio that's tuned to the warning bandwidth that any international warnings may go out on.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets his family into shelter. I'll just read this short paragraph of her, maybe, because like Bobby said, it's not just a survival of the bomb, it's all the other things. He's talking to his daughter, trying to not reassure her, but trying to make her realise that even if they don't get a direct hit, and he's saying, the bomb, if it is a weapons, that's not the only thing that could kill. This may not be an atomic war. It's more likely to be an ABC war. Atomic, biological and chemical. That's why I stocked and bottled all that air against nerve gas, aerosols, viruses, God knows what. Whoever's attacking our country won't stop if they can kill us without destroying our wealth. I wouldn't be surprised to learn that the bombs had only been used on military targets, and therefore on places like cities in New York and Detroit, they'd use nerve gas and other things. Because, of course, there's no point in taking over country if you can't then occupy it for 200 years because of the radiation. So people were talking about one of the actual biggest fears about nuclear war was the development of what's so-called clean bombs. Because the point is, of a clean bomb, you're more likely to use it because you can use it, and then the invasion can then take place after it. Because after a week or two, the very short active life of that radiation is gone. And then, of course, this is something that I remember as a young person that people were talking about, that, the governments were supposedly looking for ways of killing people, not destroying cities. I mean, they were frightening times, those Cold War times. So I think the way that those people reacted and the whole panic that was about it was really, really on the nail. And again, Bobby, I'm really going with you this week. I think, again, the only criticism I have, and I've just written it down in two words, weak door. I mean, if that door can't stand a bit of lead piping banged against it, there's no way it's going to, a 10-megaton bomb a few miles down the road, that's not going to survive that. So that was a little weak. But, of course, that was only, I think, for that lovely image that they had, as the exact moment that their heads are poking through the door is when the all clear signal goes ahead. And it was almost for that little cameo or picture that showed them, stopped them in the tracks. And I think that was the only reason why he wanted dramatically for the door to break down, for them to be actually, in. Because, of course, what they'd done when breaking that thing, they'd sealed everybody's fate, because the air raid shelter was no use once the door had been breached.
That was pretty bad that they were able to just bash in the door with a battering ram and so easily, and this shelter is supposed to protect them from a nuclear bomb, and they just did a few little batterings with the ram and the door just broke right open.
Yeah, I think there's one other thing it could have done, but might have taken things too far, and maybe people in the room want to comment on this. When I was watching it, or just rewatching it rather, should I say, it made me think, this guy's a doctor. What would have been the situation if when they're getting to the point where, they're begging to come in, he'd gone to his doctor's bag and said, this is the only thing I can do for you. This is a bottle of cyanide pills. You'll have to make the choice for your family and then go in the air raid shelter. How bleak would that have been?
Yeah. Hey, that would have been interesting.
Well, I have a question. This story is only a half an hour long, so it has to end somewhere. So everything's okay. The world doesn't end. But now what? What are they all going to do now? How are they going to live together now?
Well, I don't think there's going to be a very long building process to try and bend those bridges, isn't there? I mean, basically, I would imagine the doctor and his family would have to move away.
Yeah, that's what I said. There'd be a lot of moving vans coming in that neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah. But it was absolutely a very, very, very powerful episode. And in one way, it shouldn't be one of my favourites because, as I say, it's not science fiction. But I think maybe it's just people of a certain age. It just brings down a little bit of a cold shiver because, I was born in 46, so I remember the concern that was around, probably not making fully aware of it. But, in the early 60s, it was just my time, and here we are, the adults are threatening that the world might not be around for people like me. So, yeah. And I also remember, as a young kid, that were, I mean, when I was at school, the football pitch that we played on, sorry, soccer guys, the football pitch we played on, along the one whole side of it was a row of terraced houses, and this was like common ground behind it, and then the school was on the other side. So we played on this common ground with a couple of goalposts. But along the back of all this row of terraced house were like communal bunkers. They were like brick doors with the brick sides, and then they sloped like a triangular shape into the ground, and they were like, there was about six of them, so you could fit about 20 people in each of them. So, you know, and I do know that there were people in our street that had what they were called Nissen huts, which were like corrugated things. They wouldn't protect you from a bomb. What they were there to protect you from was any shrapnel, so that if your house was hit and there's things flying around, that would just protect you from flying bricks and tiles that might kill you from the shrapnel of it.
So
I remember once going the our local town hall, it was actually a posh house which had been converted into a library, but it was also a civic building where the council used to meet. And I remember with my friend, I can't remember whether I've told you this story before, a friend of mine, we were about 10, and we went into, they had a like a telephone box, a public telephone box within the building. So if you needed to make a telephone call, you could do. And we found out that the one of the sides of that seemed to be a very strange looking door. And one day we managed to, I don't know if it was unlocked or it was rusty or whatever, but we opened it up and it went down some stairs. And we found out there was like basically a sort of a war room, not a war room, but like an incident room down there with maps of the area on tables and that, for if they ever had to evacuate or do anything like that. I mean, it hadn't been used for 20 years or whatever, and it had obviously been there since the Second World War. But, I mean, things like that, you know, I remember little snatches and things, just enough so that you can hook into these sort of stories. So yeah. I thought it was a fabulous story, and realised, although I do take the point that Rod Sterling has had this second bite of the cherry with all the stories that he does. He always does that. But loved it, and the animation of which both Bobby and I have talked about it may give some indication of what we thought.
Well, Dave, you said that the doctor would have to move away, but don't you think that remember there was a scene where Marty and Frank Henderson was using all kinds of ethnic slurs toward Marty. I mean, how are they going to live together? How are they going to be on the same street? I wonder who's going to be able to live together and who's going to have to move.
Well, of course, the doctor puts that in words as well, right at the last scene when he's walking up the steps, doesn't he?
You're right.
That we've killed ourselves in a way.
Will they all build their own fallout shelters now?
I would if I were them, because I'm telling you, the damage that was done to these people. I mean, the one guy punching the other guy in the jaw, and and calling him a foreigner, and you know, this is what happens when you people come here to the United States. I mean, he treated them like an outcast, and at the birthday party, they were all supposed to be friends. They were all supposed to be buddies. Right.
Just very much like the masks, but without the masks.
Right,
let me just lighten the thing a little bit. One of the other things I wanted to mention was another film, which actually was a romantic comedy made in 1999. It was called Blast from the Past. It stars Brendan Fraser.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the one I brought up, yep.
Oh, you brought that up. Sorry, I must have missed that right at the beginning. But that is really a really good one. Sorry.
Or Matinee is another good one with John Goodman. If anybody wants to check that one out.
Well, when it comes to movies about the nuclear war, I think the best one ever made, I don't think anybody's mentioned it, is Fail Safe. Fail Safe with Henry Fonda.
Yeah.
Because that is a very, very disturbing movie. And it's relentless in making you nervous as it goes along. And, of course, it doesn't end very well either. Also, in but they, all these movies are quite a while ago. I'm surprised Lynn hasn't mentioned her own favorite movie, and that was God, I forgot the name of it.
You know,
the
one War Games. The
War Games.
War Games. Oh my God! Yeah, absolutely. One of my all-time favorite movies, War Games.
Would you like to play a game? How about thermonuclear war?
How about the nice game of chess? Good afternoon, Dr. Falcon.
David Lightman was a master at computer games. A fast thinker.
Oh, David! Maybe you could tell us who first suggested the idea of reproduction without sex.
Your wife?
Get out, my game.
And a promising student.
Hi.
At an old game.
Hi.
With an electronic twist.
Are those your grades?
Yeah. I don't think that I deserved an F. Do you?
You can go to jail for that.
Only if you're over 18.
This computer company is coming out with these amazing new games in a couple of months.
And I want to play those games.
Wow.
What?
You got something.
He found the right code word to play the game.
We're in.
But it was the wrong computer.
Shall we play a game?
How could I ask you that?
How about mobile thermonuclear war? Fine. All right. What the hell? They're trajectory headings for multiple impact re-entry vehicles.
How does that mean?
I don't know, but it's great.
All stations, this is Crystal Palace.
I wonder if I should use my subs.
22 Typhoon-class submarines departing Petropavlovsk.
What in the hell's happening here?
Oh, my God. Shall we play?
I have 7. Correction, 8. That's 8 Redbirds.
Get on the sack. Tell them to flush the bombers.
Russians are still denying everything, sir.
Who are you working with?
Nobody.
I don't believe you.
Over day, we have Soviet missile warning.
Based on your arrest, pending indictment for espionage.
Espionage?
Confidence is high. I repeat, confidence is high.
Over day, is this an exercise?
Negative, this is not an exercise.
Give me the president on the horn.
It's still playing the game. Stand it's gonna start a war.
Close up the mouth.
Is this a game or is it real?
War Games. Playing soon. At a theater near you.
Shall we play?
Oh, I love that movie. God, that is absolutely one of the best movies
with
ever.
With a young Matthew Broderick, yep.
Yes, yes, before he married.
I don't even mention
who he married.
all of this makes you wrong for the good old days when we were all scared to death of the nuclear war.
Broderick, that's right, yeah.
Well, I could come back at any time now, because now they're talking about the possibility of Iran trying to get their own nuclear weapon. So, you know, the next time they crash something into a building, it could be a lot worse.
I got to say something. Now, Robert, Dave, War Games, right? How about, look how long ago that was. Matthew Broderick was in a phone booth making phone calls. Not a cell phone, right? In a phone booth. Yep. And look at the size of his monitor. His computer monitor, and look at the size of his computer equipment. I mean, it was vast. This is huge computer equipment. Oh my God! It
brings
you back.
Commodore 64 or something.
Yes.
You're talking about going way back then.
Oh my God! And the,
back in the 90s, 80s, 90s.
It was so awesome. I mean, and a phone booth. Phone booths are like, you know, they're non-existent now. Oh man, I love that movie. I'm glad you brought that up, Bobby.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I think that when push comes to shove, the scariest thing is accidental nuclear war. I worry more about that than I would about anybody daring to really do anything deliberately. I mean, we may be very lucky that nothing has happened to date. That's why I think Failsafe is a very, very scary movie.
Yeah.
What was the one with John's Sellers and the one where the bloke rides the bomb down like a cowboy.
Oh, Dr. Strangelove. Love the bomb. Yeah.
Dr. Strangelove. Yeah.
Yeah, Dr. Strangelove,
yeah.
Slim Pickens riding the bomb down. Yee-haw.
That's it. Oh,
Dave, I wanted to ask you, did over in Britain, did they prepare for the way the situation is with the nuclear governments going on? Have they built any shelters or revise any shelters for if there was like a nuclear war in Britain?
It's only in the last 2-3 years that some of the information about that has been leaked out. During the Second World War, of course, underground war rooms like off the White Cliffs of Dover and things like that. But apparently in London, there are war offices deep under London, and there's actually a tube that connects that to a couple of other parts of London. And I'm sure there are the ones out and about, but nothing on any level. I think the whole thing's pretty secret. Not so much to keep it a secret from foreign lands that might want to know where to knock them out, but simply so that there's no way you can house 60 odd million people. Therefore, but no, it's a much lower key than America, but. I think a lot of this planning, our contingency planning, has been done in the past. And, of course, the height of this was all, Bay of Pigs and all those times.
Right,
I mean, one of my... apart from loving science fiction, I'm really interested in science and space travel and so on. In one sense, when America landed on the moon in 1969, in some ways I was worried about that because there was then talk that the Russians would land at another part of the moon, and then there was a lot of science fiction stories about what would happen if one of the bases was in damage. Would the Russians let the Americans go into their space station if one had an accident or something the other? And then you have the feeling that the moon's almost too big, too important to have different nations stake claims on it. I was just watching a program about the Antarctic here in the UK, one of the Christmas programs I've just caught up with, and apparently the Antarctic is unique in the world that it's all the countries of the world have agreed not to sort of lay claims on it. Well, certainly not at the moment. Maybe when the oil runs out, they will. But it's actually classed as a scientific reserve. And it's the one place where an American plane can land at a Russian base and a Russian base can land at an American one and be well received, because it's classed as a scientific laboratory, the whole of Antarctica. And I hope they do that with the moon.
That's interesting. I never heard that.
Well, I was only finding that out today. So again, it's kismet, isn't it? You find out these things just at the right time.
Yeah, really? Oh, that's cool. Huh. And that's very interesting. So, Robert.
Yes.
When's our next show?
Well, before I bring up what our next show is, I put in the chat a site where people can go and check out Jenner TV Hall of Fame Introduction Ceremony, which just happened at tuningintosci-fi.com. Go there, show number 174. I might play a little bit of it towards the end of the
TV Land?
The show. Well, what it is one of the podcasts decided to form a Hall of Fame. And one of the ones that got introduced, the very first one, is Ross Serling himself. So it might be worth to check that out and see who the other inductees are.
And where do we find this?
It's tuningintosci-fi.com. I'll air a little piece from it on our show at the end here.
Right.
So, go ahead and check it out and see who else was inducted.
Tuningintosci-fi.com.
That's it. And Felix also gave this episode a 5.2. Thank you, Dave, for typing that in there.
So our next show
is the 21st.
Yes, the 21st. And Dave, thanks for that information. Now you got that running around in my head. Thank you, Dave. No, Dave has that information running around my head, and I got to check that out. We've got that. Our next show. Our next show is the 21st of January, and that is The Passerby. And that is starring James Gregory, am I correct?
Yeah, the old boss of Matt Helm himself is in that.
Yeah,
episode, so.
the lieutenant on Barney Miller. Yeah,
yep.
Okay. So, yes. The 21st of January, Passerby, starring James Gregory. And I will hope that everyone has a wonderful weekend. And our anniversary, Bobby and I are celebrating our 1 year wedding anniversary.
Yeah, and I got to get out of here and go buy Lynn a gift. I forgot all about it.
And so we're going to be celebrating. We're having a lobster tail and all kinds of goodies. So we're going to celebrate that this weekend. And I just...
I thought we were having Big Macs and fries. What do you mean a lobster? What the
hell? Well, you're having Big Macs and fries. I'm having lobster tail. So we're having a wonderful weekend planned. And I hope everyone else has a wonderful weekend. So we'll see you on the 21st. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Goodbye. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
We'll talk to you then.
Yep.
How did this happen? Where did it go? It should have been there last week's episode. I thought I was set up with my season pass. Now the new show is out, and I don't know what happened.
The Genre Television Hall of Fame. Welcome to the inaugural Hall of Fame induction ceremony for 2011. The Genre Television Hall of Fame was established in 2011 as a way to honor those people, productions, and other entities that we, the founders of the Hall, and the listeners of Tuning Into Sci-Fi TV, believe have contributed significantly to the entertainment format we hold so dear. Genre television is either science fiction, fantasy, horror, or programs related to the culture surrounding those genres. Qualifying nominees to the Hall must have been active in genre television for at least 10 years prior to their nomination. Each year, the founders choose 3 inductees to the Hall, and our listeners select a 4th. In this inaugural year, however, we are inducting 10 initial residents of the Hall of Fame. So let's get started. Our first inductee is quite capable of introducing himself.
What you're about to see, gentlemen, is a series called The Twilight Zone. We think it's a rather special kind of series. Essentially, people watch television to get entertained. And the keynote of this series, the thing we're concerned with, the thing we're aiming for, the thing we're working toward, is entertainment. This is a series for the storyteller. Because it's our thinking that an audience will always sit still and listen and watch a well-told story.
The first ever inductee to the Genre Television Hall of Fame is Rod Serling. Rod Serling was born in New York in 1924 and passed away in 1975. He began his genre television career by writing 1953's Nightmare at Ground Zero, an episode for the Suspense anthology series. Mr. Serling was first and foremost a writer, but he may be best known by the public as the host of his groundbreaking and inspirational anthology series, The Twilight Zone, and his follow-up series, Night Gallery.
You're looking at a tableau of reality. Things of substance, of physical material, a desk, a window, a light. These things exist and have dimension. Practical joke perpetrated by Mother Nature and a combination of improbable events. Practical joke wearing the trappings of nightmare, of terror, of desperation. Small human drama played out in a desert 97 miles from Reno, Nevada. USA, continent of North America, the Earth, and of course, the Twilight Zone.
We're truly delighted that you've come. I mean, anyone can go to the movies or a night doubleheader or a discotheque or what have you, but only the tasteful visit a place like this.
We congratulate all of the inductees this year. Once again, here are the new members of the Hall of Fame. Rod Serling, Jerry Anderson, Superman, the team of William Hanna and Joseph Barbera, the universe of Doctor Who, Gene Roddenberry, the universe of the Night Stalker, Rockne S. O'Bannon, The X-Files, and Joss Whedon. To learn more about the Hall of Fame and to learn how you can participate, please visit TuningIntoSciFiTV.com.